Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
When you are a writer, an illustrator, and indeed an editor, obviously you've got to juggle a whole range of things around, although maybe you can just hand it all over to ChatGPT. No, let's not talk about that yet. We're delighted at present to welcome the human being that is full-time freelance writer, editor, and illustrator extraordinaire, of course. It's the wonderful Karen Melberg-Schweier. How are you, Karen?
I'm fine. How are you? Hello from Canada.
Well, great to connect with a good self. I just want to confirm it. Is it Schweier or Schweer?
Schweer rhymes
beer.
With
rhymes as in with beer. There we yes. are. Of course, exactly. This is it. It's important we get those Germanic Teutonic pronunciations correct. Basically,
Karen, I'm Swedish and I married a German. So
there you are. This is it. Exactly. So the ideal Northern Hemisphere global North connection there.
Fusion cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, again, just going straight into the notion of that writer and illustrator, etc. Clearly a polymath from the whole side of things there. You write for local and national magazines. You have a variety of, obviously, connections with nonprofit organizations, businesses, government agencies and so on. And you photograph as well. Was this something you'd always intended to become basically skilled in all of these art crafts? Or was it a case of, well, this is transmedia storytelling at its best?
This was something that started way back when I was in high school, and I started working for a weekly newspaper in Alberta, Canada. And I think I was really lucky in my career to just fall into journalism opportunities throughout. I don't know, it just happened.
Well, again, it's the narrative of journalism. Let's grasp the nettle, though, before we actually go into any background. Let's grasp that artificial intelligence ChatGPT aspect, which we've spoken extensively about already with writers coming to the New York Book Festival and so on. Is it something we should be concerned about? Is it something which is going to happen whether we want it to or not? Or is it a case of, well, it could be a big asset to the human race? And look at how technology can assist. Your own thoughts, please.
I think we shouldn't be afraid of it. I think we need to understand it and probably look at how it can be applied positively and negatively. And I mean, as with any technology, I mean, there's always the initial, oh my God, this is going to replace human beings and replace writers, and I won't have to actually come up with a story. I'll just ask AI to do it for me. I think we need to be cautious. I think we need a lot of study. My husband's an academic and has spent his career looking at instructional technology, developing communities online, teaching students how to, you know, really critically look at what they're seeing online and in social media, not just turn yourself over to it, but really critically examine what you're seeing, what the applications are, what it might be doing. And I think informing yourself, educating yourself about the possibilities is probably the most critical thing.
And that ultimately is perhaps what education is about, really, looking to develop the innate critical perspective of individuals and so on. Maybe back in the day, people thought that the typewriter would have actually meant the end of everything, because without writing on a quill pen, clearly it just wasn't the same in any way, shape or form. We'll turn now to one of our wonderful correspondents who's originally from North Carolina, but she's currently in Dublin, where she's doing her master's in children's literature. And may have one or two things to say about ChatGPT as well. Not that she's ever used it for her essays at all, I can guarantee that. Jessica Burtis. Jessica, any questions you'd like to put to our special author of the week today about life, the universe, etc.? That, of course, is Karen Melberg-Schweier.
Yes, hello. I'm very curious about what was happening with ChatGPT. Were you discussing this?
Well, AI, I guess, and...
Yeah, we can guarantee, as far as I'm aware, we are all human beings at this particular aspect, but it is something which I spent a good hour This morning, actually, in conversation with colleagues in Hong Kong about how they're actually developing strategies and work within that, and they actually embrace it. So, it could be another issue. So, it's obviously percolating through the atmosphere. Moving on, we'll hand over to Jessica in a moment. I'm fascinated, actually, Karen, by one of your favorite interviews had you digging into the childhood memories of a Hollywood actor. Do we get any sneak reveal in terms of who that happens to be? I mean, there are a lot of actors in Hollywood, obviously.
Well, I'm assuming that he's known where you are. Kim Coates was actually from Saskatoon and ended up in Hollywood. He was in Waterworld with Kevin Costner. He was in Sons of Anarchy, that series that ran. He's done a number of big and small projects, and we had a local magazine called Fine Lifestyles, and we just kind of wanted to chat with a Saskatoon boy gone to Hollywood.
Makes sense. And of course, you also interviewed a couple of Ukrainian babas, basically grandmothers, I suspect, basically one both non-Ajdarians, actually, one 90 and the other 96, sisters who still garden in their Saskatoon backyards. I mean, I'm sure.
Than I could ever hope to have.
I'm sure that they would have had one or two things to say about the current situation there, either in the Ukraine or may still have, basically. But that's another thing. Jessica. Back to yourself, please. Questions for our guest.
Yeah, I would love to know what some of your projects coming up are and what you've been working on.
Well, I've just, where is it? This is my debut novel, and it's just been re-released by a new publisher. It sold out of the first three printings and has just been re-released last month. So it's off to a wider audience, hopefully. So I've been doing some promotion around that book. I did a reading last night, and I'm working on the sequel to that. It's based on a true story. It's a historical Canadian prairie fiction. And when I was told the original story years ago, I just thought that would make a fantastic novel or a movie. And it just kind of wouldn't let me go. So the original farmer who told me the story came to visit me after this one was published. And I said, could you tell me the original story again? Because I'd really like to have it recorded. Sure, he started telling me the story. And about 5 minutes into it, he dropped this bombshell of a detail that he'd never told me before. And I said, Hank, what? You never mentioned that. Oh, sure, yeah, I think that's what happened, really. Had I known that, this first novel wouldn't have been written the way it was, but it was perfect for the sequel. Because I had some... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
My first editor had pulled off about 50 pages of the original manuscript and said, this is your second novel. Here's where your first novel ends. You save this for your second novel. And I thought, I don't know if I can even produce a first novel, let alone a second one. But she was pretty confident that there would be an additional story, but it was kind of, I knew where it would end, but it wasn't really working for me until Hank dropped this little bit of information. And so the second novel came together. I think I started it in March, and a good manuscript was finished by September. So there's
and
a
how you... Yeah, that leads into what I was thinking, because I'm wondering how you found the process of writing a sequel, because I know for a lot of authors, writing a sequel can feel very different from kind of writing that first book.
Well, it's tricky because you want it to be a standalone story for, you know, because obviously not everybody's read the first one. So that was, I think, what I found most challenging was, you know, we've got all the same characters that were introduced in the first. How do I reintroduce those without just going over the same introductions again? And it had to be linked to that first narrative, but you know, it's got the new bits and pieces. So that was a big challenge. And then writing the twist, because I really wanted that true incident to be reflected in the sequel. How do I tie that back into what we thought happened in the first? You know what I mean? Everybody who finished the first novel, well, that's what happened. But did it really? And so to connect those two in a meaningful way, in a way that would make sense, not just, you know, not just kind of trying to ram that new information into the first. So that was tricky.
I mean, for many people, actually, the thought of writing a novel can be exhausting, but to actually be in its second printing with your debut novel, of course, Small Reckonings, it's clearly an impressive line from that. Of course, there is a long history, Karen, of journalists actually becoming novelists. Was that something you were conscious of? Did you always have the great Canadian novel in mind that would be written sometime in your life journey?
Absolutely not. I had done a couple of children's books, but most of my books have been nonfiction and mostly about life experiences of people with disabilities. So, I mean, I had that background. I had a farm background. I had done a whole series of profiles of homesteaders in Canada when I was quite young. So I had, and I was always interested in historical, you know, homesteading stories, that kind of thing. And I mean, it literally just walked through the door when this farmer showed up and told me this story. And I'd never tried any, you know, significant fiction before, but it just wouldn't leave me alone. I mean, I carried it around probably for a couple of years, and I just kept, these characters just kept rolling around in my head. So I just to get them out of there, I had to do something.
It's set between 1914 and 1936, so you've got a very turbulent period of history there, the start of the Great War, of course, as it was referred to in Europe, and obviously the Depression era of 1936 and so on. As we look back now from the 21st century perspective on those particular times, do you feel as though we still don't learn the lessons of the past? We're still kind of staggering backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past? Or are there areas in which that particular part, certainly of Canada, with respect to multi-ethnic pioneers, the whole notion of how the town actually operates, is that something which is constantly under exploration? It's shifting because our perspective obviously changes, just as in the same way somebody who writes about the partition of India, shall we say, from a contemporary's perspective, would find, you know, writing from what was happening in 1950 again, interesting from a research point of view and indeed a practical point of view.
We do seem to be doomed to repeat mistakes of the past, aren't we? One thing that a lot of readers have mentioned, because where the time period where my story was set, there was the you know, the influenza epidemic, and you know, people were, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people died. As I was writing the sequel, you know, the pandemic was well underway, and there were so many parallels about, you know, what the panic that people thought, the lack of panic that a lot of people thought, that, oh, this isn't, you know, this isn't much of a problem. You know, I don't know. There just seemed to be parallels with that kind of issue, with the treatment of immigrants who came and homesteaded in Saskatchewan. You know, at that time, Ukrainian settlers were, you know, viewed with a little bit of suspicion, as were Germans. So those kinds of, I guess, ethnic stereotypes, you know, seem to still hang around and present themselves yet today. So I wonder why we don't learn.
Yeah, I mean, the story actually tells the tale of William, an adventurer from New Zealand, bringing his city bride to the freshly broken earth of his farm near Watrous, Saskatchewan. Violet, the child born feeble-minded, plunges her mother Louise, a woman burdened with a secret, back to a time of guilt and regret. The child draws out goodness and loyalty in her neighbours, Hank and Emily. I suspect this is a bit of a tearjerker, Karen.
Well, yeah, one of the reviews I've got was, I laughed, I cried, you probably will too, which sounds a little cliche, but I mean, this sounds silly, but I can reread sections, especially sections that were very difficult to write, around sexual assault, you know, at that time, late 1920s, 30s. And I get a little weepy thinking about Violet. Characters do ride around in your head. I always thought that authors just made that up, that they become so real, but I still dream about them and wonder what they're doing, which is probably why I had to do the sequel. I had to get them out of there again.
As a saga, will the story continue? Will there be a third in the series?
Nobody's ever asked me that before. I don't know. I have it neatly wrapped up at the end. So, actually, there is probably something that could carry on, but let me get through the second.
Absolutely. There's obviously a generational thing, et cetera, because there's at least a century between when the book starts and where conceivably the saga could actually end. So you can go through other challenging times. Right. Jessica, back to you.
Just took me a second to find the unmute button. Sorry. I'm really wanting to know what you find to be the most rewarding part of writing these books.
I think, you know, it probably goes back to when I was a kid on the farm, and I would just spend hours. My brother was 4 years older, and so he was off to school, and I would just be on the farm exploring. I grew up in Washington State near Seattle, and I just remember having such a rich childhood experience with farm animals and the woods and exploring and being able to kind of sit downstairs in our guest room for 2-3 day writing retreats at a time, when my husband would look after our son and would deliver meals to the door and wonderful things like that. And I would just sink back into that childhood imagination and dig into that well of all those memories and details. And I think that's a key to good fiction writing, is having those authentic details that really make the scene, you know, come alive for people, come alive for readers who can recognize their own past or stories from their own grandparents. So many of the readers that I've spoken to, book clubs and things like that, have talked about how we had that same exact thing on our farm, or that's, you know, we knew somebody with a disability in the small town, you know, back in the 30s. And so I think writing in a way that resonates with people is really important, and you're very lucky if you can pull that off.
And do you have a favorite character, or is it kind of like trying to pick between children, where it's not possible?
Well, I don't know if it's because he's the true farmer who told me the story originally, but I really have a thing for Hank, and he's sort of the neighboring farmer that in the sequel has been tasked with looking after Violet. And in fact, the sequel is called Inheriting Violet. So in fact, my editor, my original editor, with the first publisher, she would get so irritated with me, because as we worked through the manuscript, she would say, "Do you love this guy, or what is he doing in this scene? He does not need to be in this scene. Just get rid of him." And I always thought, yeah, but he really was there in the original story. So I really had to work at separating what really happened, you know, that the seed of that true story, with the fiction that I was creating. And well, no, he does. It's fiction. He doesn't have to be there. So that was a challenge.
And have you found that your characters will surprise you? You were saying that they kind of go around in your mind of their own accord. So have they ever kind of done a twist on the story in your own head?
Yes, absolutely. And I thought that was something that authors used to make up too, but I will be writing thinking I'm going to get him to get to this point, and I'll go back and reread it the next day, and I'll say, oh no, that's not what he meant to do, he's going to do this instead. And that happened fairly frequently, and then it seemed like once I got him doing what he was supposed to be doing, the writing would take off and I'd head in that direction. And then you get, and I don't know if other writers do this, I would imagine they do, you get to a point where you're getting these different threads together, and at the end it kind of goes clunk, like a puzzle piece. You think, yeah, that's what everything was meant to get to that point, even though you're not consciously thinking of it.
Whilst we've been talking, I've been having a look at some of the wonderful illustrations you've produced, Karen, and we had a little look at that side of things there, and a number of laugh out loud moments in many ways there. Particularly impressed with the, and I'll describe it as best as possible for radio, the young child with the violin whose teacher is gazing along wonderfully at him and saying the words, the strap line. That was wonderful, Leonard. But according to our early assessments, you aren't able to do that. And there are lots of lines with respect to that, which kind of, I suppose, talk about breaking those preconceptions from that point of view. I mean, there's another which has a child in a wheelchair with the line, I know I can get my wheelchair through that door, but I don't know how I'm going to get my body into that machine, as he goes into an examination room, and obviously a doctor from that point of view. Was that something, again, that using humour, gentle humour, admittedly, and illustrations, it does address some of the issues that people who are differently enabled, classified as disabled, whatever, that they're faced with on a day-by-day basis?
I think so. I think sometimes it's easy to get very preachy about how people with disabilities should be included, how they should have their own voice, how, you know, it's easy for us to you know, lecture people and say that, you know, this is how we make the world better for people. But I think sometimes just, you know, just a quiet, humorous reminder of people's humanity and things we assume about people with disabilities can just maybe make that difference. It's, you know, people don't like to be preached at, they don't like to be lectured to, but maybe a little bit of humor will go a long way. Our son has a disability, and we've had people, not so much lately, because I think attitudes are better, and I think information is a little more out in the open. But when he was younger, people used to come up to us in front of Jim and say, what's his IQ? And my husband would say, well, I'm not really sure. What's yours? And I have no idea. Well, why would that be? What's the purpose of that question? Or, I mean, Jim himself would, sometimes people would come up to him and be talking to us and then turn to him and talk in a very childish, you know, baby talk voice. And at one point, a neighbor lady did that and, you know, and got kind of down, and he's fairly short, got down and just, when, how are you today? And he looked at us and went. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think the more people are around people with disabilities, the more, you know, just normalized living together is. You know, you get to know people as people rather than as a disability.
Yeah, very critical. We used to have a thing called the "Do they take sugar?" syndrome. We think, well, you talk about them in the third person. They think, I'm right here. You know, I can't actually hear you. Hello.
Yeah, could you ask me what I want in the restaurant? You don't have to ask who I'm with.
Yeah, very true. Just looking back at the illustrations, do you have any influences? Is it a self-taught style? Is it a format that you'd actually developed? Or are there other particular caricaturists or indeed political cartoonists that you've adopted to say, yeah, I'm going to go for that style?
Not really. I used to, you know, again, back to the farm childhood. My brother was away and I would just entertain myself by drawing pictures. And just always really enjoyed doing that. And then as I got older, I started working for newspapers, I would end up, you know, being asked to do, you know, political cartoons, you know, events that were happening and you know, do a funny take on that. I've admired some people and have a little collection where I would, you know, write a letter off to somebody and say, well, I, you know, really enjoy your work, and would get a little letter back with a little illustration on it. So I have a little collection of those framed pieces. But generally it's, and today, I mean, I guess I just sort of wait for freelance projects. You know, if a lot of the disability stuff that you mentioned was done specifically for a professor in California who was teaching disability studies. So would use a lot of that kind of cartoon in her class. So it's something I really like to do, but with the writing, that sort of has taken over my my time in the last few years.
But you have written 8 books with a focus on the lives of people with intellectual disabilities, edited several others from that point of view, one of them being translated into German, Italian, and Korean. Do you feel as though we are, again, it's the old question of progress, do you feel as though we're moving to that environment where we do acknowledge people as being aspects of the divine, aspects of fellow travelers, fellow pilgrims, and our experience on the planet, as opposed to being othered and said, oh, they can't possibly do this because?
I think I would like to think that we've made a lot of progress. Sometimes it worries me when we've worked so hard for so long to get people out of large congregated institutions where people spent their entire lives kind of being locked away. And we go through this whole process of moving people out, supporting them in the community, involving them in everyday community life and in employment or volunteer or just being a part of us rather than having this us and them kind of set up. And then a government will come along and say, oh, you know what we could do? We could really put all these people in a facility and it would be a lot cheaper and we'll just house them there and have a bunch of staff who look after them. And you think, no, we've spent the last 30 years trying to move away from that model. But it's tempting for sometimes for decision makers to, just look at the economics of something rather than the humanity of people.
Yes, we have a phrase at the University of Lincoln called management by spreadsheet. And I think in many ways that's pretty much the line that you're taking there. And I think in most cases, various folk over the years get affected and impacted by that on the basis of you're seeing the whole process in terms of economic units as opposed to individual aspects. And we need obviously folk like yourself to continue to raise that banner. We're on to nutrition now, and you may or may not actually have a response to this particular side of things, but it is a Jessica Burtis patented, it is actually duly patented question. Copyright Jessica Burtis from
It
times 2011, 2012, etc. So, Karen, if you're ready for this, obviously up in Saskatchewan, etc., Jessica, go for the nutrition-based question.
I'm scared. I'm scared
is. We love to ask if anyone has ever heard of sweet tea or boiled peanuts, or if you've tried them, as they're both extremely popular snacks from my home.
Sweet tea. Well, my husband is from Indiana. So that rings a bell. What was the second thing?
Boiled peanuts.
Boiled peanuts. Oh, sure. Georgia.
Yeah.
We'd drive down to see his parents in Florida and stop for boiled peanuts.
Yes, exactly. I'm so glad to hear that. It's usually people are like, a peanut? Why would you boil a peanut?
Oh, sure.
It's
Yeah. They're
amazing.
good. Yeah. And boiled chestnuts. Have you had that?
I've never tried that. I should when I go home.
Yeah. Do you get home very often?
I'll be going home for the summer, so
Oh, nice.
I'll be back soon. I can have all the sweet tea I want eventually. Are there any snacks that are particular to Saskatchewan?
Oh boy. Well, everybody thinks of poutine when they think of Canada, which is
Yes.
I don't care for it, but it's kind of the French fries with gravy and cheese curds on top, which sounds kind of awful, but people love it.
It depends whether or not you want to have a cardiac arrest, basically, I would have thought, really, in terms of the
You
range of
don't
things
need it.
there.
You just inject it into your
Yeah,
veins.
yeah, yeah.
Oh, let's see. I'm just drawing a blank. Isn't that terrible?
It's okay. You'll remember later at like 3 a.m. You're like, oh, wait a second.
We just had moose stew for supper the other night.
Like actual moose.
And deer. We usually have deer meat and moose isn't that common where we are, but a lot of people go up north and bring home a moose.
So have you seen a moose in the wild?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Wow.
When we first moved to Canada, we moved up to just south of the Yukon in British Columbia, and they were everywhere. You'd see them. I mean, it was a little tiny village. It was kind of an old gold rush village, and sometimes you'd just sort of see one walking down the back lane. They're very
As
big.
as Northern exposure would actually have it. It genuinely occurs in all sorts of ways.
Exactly.
More a
Exactly.
drama documentary.
We had a neighbor who was a game warden, and apparently the mother had been shot or died somehow. But we had a wolf pup who lived next door, and he liked to come visit because my mom would feed him ice cream. So he would break his chain and come over to our house and put his paws up on the basement door, and she could hear him scratching. So she'd go down and he'd put his paws on her shoulders, and she'd say, "Okay, you have to get down so I can get the ice cream out of the freezer." And she'd give him a bowl of ice cream, and then I'd take him back to his house.
That
Until
sounds like the cutest idea for a book to write.
he eventually got very big and a little bit difficult to handle, so he went to live on a game preserve in southern BC, I think.
Let's talk music. Some authors, some writers, some specialists have a particular soundtrack they like to play to carry on their work. Some prefer to have absolute silence. Any particular artists or genres you like to listen to when you're not actually sort of, engaging with illustrations or indeed editing or such like?
Oh, well, now here's a question. When I'm writing, I can't have any noise. I can't have the TV on in the background. I mean, it's got to be quiet, quiet. My husband can have the IU basketball game on. He can have music going. He can, my son can be doing things. I've got to have quiet when I'm writing. But this is a shameless plug, but our son is a musician, our other son, and he plays with a band called Rye. Rhye, and they've done a lot of European tours, Middle East. So I'm a fan of whatever band is playing.
So there we are. It's always worth accessing from that point of view. Rhye, Rhye. Do they have a website? Is there a way in which people can actually follow them and actually get access their material online?
Yeah, you can just Google Rye, Rhye, and there you have
And
it.
would Fearless have been one of their numbers or Passing?
I don't think so.
Oh, right. We have Rye here, basically a music video by Rye performing Fearless. I was wondering whether that might have actually accessed the whole thing. We've had The Fall, we've had Open. Maybe it's a different,
Oh,
maybe
that's it. Yes, open. Yes, that's
Open.
the one.
That's what we'll go out there. Rye with Open. Fantastic stuff there. Jessica, any further questions you want to put into the mix at present?
I would just have to say, if you had to give a one sentence description to hook someone for your book, what would you say?
Oh, that's hard. This is supposed to be the shortened elevator speech that you that
Yes, a pitch.
oh, I would say historical prairie fiction that touches on our perceptions of disability, sexual assault, and forgiveness. How's that?
Very good. I think
That's
you know.
perfect.
Yeah, we ramp up the quality questions. But if the interview continued, we'll be asking for your views on existential psychoanalysis as well. But we'll leave that for another return. They're
Good.
very important. Jessica, we have reached the last two questions. Would you like to put the first one to our ace author of the week today? Of course, the fabulous Karen Melberg-Schwer.
Yes. Karen, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Oh, this was so fun. I'm always a little bit nervous about doing interviews, especially when I kind of don't know what's going to be thrown at me. But this was really fun, and to have the two of you kind of tag teaming was fun as well. I really enjoyed this, and it's 9:30 in the morning here, and I was worried that I wouldn't be awake, but here we are.
Well, then the next critical question we need to put to you is, Karen, would you be kind enough to return in the not too distant future? Will you come back so we can move the discourse up even further?
And with any luck, keep your fingers crossed, I will be pleased to talk about the sequel.
Exactly so. Well, the task isn't quite over yet because we'd like you to wrap up, given that your son is performing with this band, to actually give us the heads up into what we're about to hear now to wrap up this whole sequence. It's Open by the band Rye. Over to you, please, Karen.
wonderful Canadian led band. My son Benjamin is on the piano, so just enjoy.
Stay, don't close your hands. I wanna make this